ladies and gentlemen, to the Vancouver Institute. I'm going to make my usual, by now rather monotonous, introductory remarks. We do want you all to join the Vancouver Institute. Our views, by the standards of our day, are next to nothing. $10 for an adult membership, $15 for a family. It's very important that you join the Institute. Even more important, perhaps, that you make a donation if you can. Both memberships and donations are tax deductible. Just a word about procedures tonight. Mr. Golding wishes to read two autobiographical statements that will take some 35 minutes. Then we will, as is Institute custom, we will leave this hall and field questions in the overflow rooms, come back here, field more questions, and then Mr. Golding would like to make a final statement. So we have, as it were, tonight the procedure is a sandwich with a talk at the beginning and the end and questions in the middle. So that's the arrangement. And I should say, too, for those of you who are watching this from the lobby, I regret that we will not be able to go there to take questions. So those of you who are in the lobby will be able to hear, of course, the whole evening, to see most of it, but not to ask questions. Well, it is my great pleasure tonight to introduce William Golding, one of the best-known writers of our day, and the recipient, in 1983, of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Mr. Golding was born in Cornwall in 1911. Educated in one of the well-known English grammar schools, Marlborough, and then at Oxford. After Oxford, he worked as an actor, as a producer in small theater companies, and as a teacher. His first published volume, Poems, appeared in 1935. During the war, he was in the Royal Navy, a lieutenant in command of a rocket ship. After the war, in 1954, he published his first and perhaps his most famous novel, Lord of the Flies. Other writing followed in quick succession. The Inheritors, 1955. Pincher Martin, 1956. A play, The Brass Butterfly, 1958. Free Fall, 1959. The Spire, 1964. And a collection of essays, The Hot Gates, in 1965. His later novels are The Pyramid, 1967, three novellas under the title The Scorpion God, 1971, Darkness Visible, 1979, Rites of Passage, for which he was awarded the Booker Prize for the best novel of the year, the counterpart in English of the Prix Goncourt, in France, and A Moving Target, 1982. Of his two most recent novels, The Paper Man, 1984, and An Egyptian Journal, 1985, the former describes a famous English novelist pursued by an American academic, who in Golding's words would make the author the raw material of an academic light industry. Well, I suppose, sir, that the academic light industry is somewhat irrepressible, but it is far from our primary purpose here tonight. You are among many here in Vancouver who admire your work, who appreciate your kindness in coming so far. And I must say, particularly, this is the end of the Goldings' long Canadian travels. They've crisscrossed this country, stopping to lecture in eight cities. I suggested to them they traveled at least 4,000 miles. They assured me they traveled much, much farther than that because they backtracked a good many, many times. It is they've had a very long, arduous Canadian safari. So they really have come a long way. So we appreciate that, sir. We look forward very much to your thoughts and readings tonight. Mr. Golding.
My wife has just commented on the fact that Professor Gold Harris and I have been walking up and down outside like a couple of expectant fathers, which was, I suppose, apposite to the nature of the building in some ways. I'm also happy to know that I'm tax deductible at last. The experience of lecturing and reading around a number of continents has led me to believe that when readers of novels see a novelist in front of him, in front of them, the last thing they want him to do is to explain his books to them. Either they have not read any of his books, in which case the explanation is irrelevant, or they have read the books and know what they think about them and are curious to come and see the creature that stood behind them. For that reason, I have been, I won't say forced, but brought more and more to see this kind of tour as an essay in demure exhibitionism in which I allow you to see as much of the novelist's nature as is proper. It's so, I'm in Canada as in England, that if you are christened William, you are never called William. You are either Will or Willie or Bill or Billy. I started by being Billy, and the first of the biographical essays I shall read to you is about me when I was called Billy. In an extraordinary way, these two essays have prefigured the rest of my life, my adult life. I don't know why that should be. Some sort of divination, I suppose, made me write them many years ago, knowing that they would, as it were, come in handy later on. And they do, when taken together, render, and this is a warning I'm handing to some people I happen to know are in this room and in the overflows, it is these two essays render any future biography entirely unnecessary. Well, the first one then, Billy, and as will emerge from the essay, and for various reasons I entitled it Billy the Kid. On the first day, Lily, my nurse, took me to school. We went hand in hand through the churchyard, down the town hall steps and along the south side of the high street. The school was at the bottom of an alley, two rooms, one downstairs and one upstairs, a staircase, a place for hanging coats and a lavatory. Miss kept the school, handsome, good-tempered miss, whom I liked so much. Miss used the lower room for prayers and singing and drill and meetings, and the upper one for all the rest. Lily hung my coat up, took me upstairs, and deposited me among a score or so of children who ranged in age from 5 to 11. The boys were neatly dressed, and the girls overdressed, if anything. Miss taught in the old-fashioned way, catering for all ages at once. I was difficult. No one had suggested before this time that anything mattered outside myself. I was used to being adored, for I was an attractive child in an Anglo-Saxon sort of way. Indeed, my mother, in her rare moments of lyricism, would declare that I had eyes like cornflowers and hair like a field of ripe corn, reaped less. I had known no one outside my own family, nothing but walks with Lily or my parents and long holidays by a Cornish sea. I had read much for my age, but saw no point in figures. I had a passion for words in themselves and collected them like stamps or birds' eggs. I had also a clear picture of what school was to bring me. It was to bring me fights. I lacked opposition and yearned to be victorious. Achilles, Lancelot, and Aeneas should have given me a sense of human nobility, but they gave me instead a desire to be a successful bruiser. It did not occur to me that school might have discipline or that numbers might be necessary. While therefore I was supposed to be writing out my tables or even dividing 4 oranges between 2 poor boys, I was more likely to be scrawling a list of words. While I was supposed to be learning my collect, I was likely to be chanting inside my head a list of delightful words which I had picked up, God knows where, Debris and Skirmishar, Crescant and Suicide. On this first day, when Miss taxed me with my apparent inactivity, I smiled and said nothing but nothing until she went away. At the end of the week, she came to see my mother. I stuck my field of ripe corn round the dining room door and listened to them as they came out of the drawing room. My mother was laughing gaily and talking in her front door voice. "He's just a little butterfly, you know, just a butterfly." Miss replied judiciously, "We'd better let that go for a while." So let go it was. I drew ships and aeroplanes with all their strings and waited for the bell. I had quickly narrowed my interest in education to the quarter of an hour between 11 and 15 minutes past. This was break when our society at last lived up to my expectations. While Miss sat at her desk and drank tea, we spent the break playing and fighting in the space between the desks and the door. The noise rose slowly in shrillness and intensity, so that I could soon assess the exact note at which Miss would ring a handbell and send us back to our books. If we were dull and listless, break might be extended by as much as 10 minutes. So there was a constant conflict in my mind. A desire to be rowdy and a leader in rowdiness, together with the knowledge that success would send us back to our desks. The games were numerous and varied with our sex. The girls played with dolls or at weddings. Most of the time they played postman's knock among themselves, played it seriously like a kind of innocent apprenticeship. Tap, tap. "Who's there?" "A letter for Mary." We boys ignored them with a contempt of inexpressible depth. We did not kiss each other, not we. We played tag or fought in knots and clusters, while Miss drank tea and smiled indulgently and watched our innocent apprenticeship. Fighting proved to be just as delightful as I'd thought. I was chunky and zestful and enjoyed hurting people. I exulted in victory, in the complete subjugation of my adversary, and thought that they should enjoy it too, or at least be glad to suffer for my sake. For this reason, I was puzzled when the supply of opponents diminished. Soon I had to corner victims before I could get a fight at all. Imperceptibly, the gay picture altered. Once back in our desks, where the boys were safe from me, they laughed at me and sniggered. I became the tinder to a catchword. Amazed behind my eager fist, I watched them and saw they were, but what were they? Appearances must lie, for of course they could not drive themselves from behind those aimed eyes, could not persuade themselves that I, Ego Billy, whom everyone loved and cherished as by nature, could not persuade themselves that I was not uniquely woven of precious fabric. Could it be? Nonsense. Sky, fly, pie, soup, hoop, croup, Georgius. But there were whisperings in corners and on the stairs. There were cabals and meetings. There were conversations which ceased when I came near. Suddenly, in break, when I tried to fight, the opposition fled with screams of hysterical laughter, then combined in democratic strength and hurled itself on my back. As for the little girls, they no longer played postman's knock, but danced on the skirts of the scrum and screamed encouragement to the just majority. That break ended early. At the end of the morning, I was left disconsolate in my desk. The other boys and girls clamoured out purposefully. I wandered after them, puzzled at a changing world. But they had not gone far. They were grouped on the cobbles of the alley outside the door. The boys stood warily in a semicircle, their satchels swinging loose like inconvenient shillelaghs. The girls were ranged behind them, ready to send their men into the firing line. The girls were excited and giggling, but the boys were pale and grim. "Go on," shouted the girls, "go on." The boys took cautious steps forward. Now I saw what was to happen, felt shame and the bitterness of all my seven beings. Humiliation gave me strength. My rolled up exercise book became an epic sword. I went mad. With what felt like a roar, but must really have been a pig squeal, I leapt at the nearest boy and hit him squarely on the nose. Then I was round the semicircle, hewing and thumping like Achilles in the riverbed. The screams of the little girls went needle sharp. A second or two later, they and the boys were broken and running up the alley, piling through the narrow entry and erupting into the high street. I stood alone on the cobbles, and a wave of passionate sorrow engulfed me. Indignation and affront, shame and frustration took command of my muscles and my lungs. My voice rose in a sustained howl, for all the world as though I had been the loser and they had chased Achilles back to his tent. I began to zigzag up the alley, head back, my voice serenading a vast sorrow in the sky. My feet found their way along the high street, and my sorrow went before me like a brass band, past the antique shop, the international stores, Barclays Bank, past the tobacconists and the Green Dragon, with head back and grief as shrill and steady as a siren. How can one record and not invent? Is there any point in understanding the nature of a small boy crying? Yet if I am to tell the small, the unimportant truth, it is a fact that my sorrows diminished unexpectedly and woefully up the street. What had been universal became an army with banners, became soon so small that I could carry it before me, as it were, in two hands. Still indignant, still humiliated, still moving zigzag with little running impulses and moments of pause, I had my grief where I could hold it out and see it. Look! Some complexity of nature added three persons to my seven devils, or perhaps brought three of the seven to my notice. There was Billy grieving, smitten to the heart. There was Billy, who felt the unfairness of having to get this grief all the way home where his mother could inspect it. And there was scientific Billy, who was rapidly acquiring know-how. I suspected that my reservoirs were not sufficient for the waters of lamentation, suspected that my voice would disappear and that I was incapable of a half mile's sustained emotion. I began to run, therefore, so that my sorrow would last. When suspicion turned to certainty, I cut my crying to a whimper and settled to the business of getting it home. Past the Aylesbury Arms, across the London Road, through Oxford Street for the Wesleyan Chapel, turn left for the last climb in the Green, and there my feelings inflated like a balloon so that I did the last 20 yards as tragically as I could have wished, swimming through an ocean of sorrow, all paradoxically enough quite genuine, swung on the front door knob, stumbled in, staggered to my mother. "Why, Billy, whatever's the matter?" Balloon bursts, floods, tempests, hurricanes, rage and anguish, a monstrous yell. "They don't like me." My mother administered consolation and the hesitant suggestion that perhaps some of the transaction had been my fault. But I was beyond the reach of such footling ideas. She comforted, my father and Lily hovered, until at last I was quiet enough to eat. My mother put on her enormous hat and went out with an expression of grim purpose. When she came back, she said she thought everything would be all right. I continued to eat and sniff and hiccup. I brooded righteously on what was going to happen to my schoolfellows now that my mother had taken a hand. They were, I thought, probably being sent to bed without anything to eat, and it would serve them right and teach them to love me and not be cruel. After lunch, I enjoyed myself darkly, scaffold, birch, wreck, inventing possible punishments for them. Lovely punishments. Miss called later and had a long talk with my mother in the drawing room. As she left, I stuck my field of ripe corn round the dining room door again and saw them. "Bring him along a quarter of an hour late," said Miss. "That's all I shall need." My mother inclined her stately head. "I know the children don't really mean any harm, but Billy is so sensitive." We were back to normal again then. Next day, Lily took me to school a quarter of an hour later than usual. We went right in, right upstairs. Everyone was seated, and you could have stuck a fork into the air of noiseless excitement. I sat in my desk, Lily went, and school began. Wherever I looked, there were faces that smiled shyly at me. I inspected them for signs of damage, but no one seemed to have suffered any crippling torment. I reached for a rubber, and a girl in pink and plaits leaned over. "Borrow mine." A boy offered me a handkerchief. Another passed me a note with, "Will you join my gang?" written on it. I was in. We began to say our tables. I only had to pause for breath before giving an answer to six sevens for a gale of whispers to suggest sums varying from 39 to 45. Dear Miss had done her work well, and today I should enjoy hearing her 15 minutes homily on brotherly love. Indeed, school seemed likely to come to a full stop from sheer excess of charity. So Miss, smiling remotely, said we would have an extra long break. My heart leapt, because I thought that now we could get on with some really fierce friendly fighting, with even perhaps a bloody nose. But Miss produced the train set. When the other boys got down to fixing rails, the girls, inexpressibly moved by the homily, seized me in a posse. I never stood a chance against those excited arms, those tough silken chests, those bird-whistling mouths, that mass of satin and serge and wool and pigtails and ribbons. Before I knew where I was, I found myself, my cornflowers popping out of my head, playing postman's knock. The first girl to go outside set the pattern. "A parcel for Billy Golding." In and out I went like a weaver's shuttle, pecked, pushed, hugged, mouthed and mauled, in and out, from fair to dark, to red, from Eunice, who had had fever and a crop, to Big Martha, who could sit on her hair. I kissed the lot. This was, I suppose, my first lesson. I cannot think it was successful, for I did not know about the homily. I merely felt that the boys and girls who tried to do democratic justice on me had been shown to be wrong. I was, and now they knew it, a thoroughly likable character. I was unique and precious after all, and I still wondered what punishments their parents had found for them, which had forced them to realize the truth. I still refused to do my lessons, confronting Miss with an impenetrable placidity. I still enjoyed fighting, if I was given the chance. I still had no suspicion that Billy was anything but perfect. At the end of term, when I went down to Cornwall, I sat in a crowded carriage with my prized book open on my knees for 6 hours, Cherub, Seraph, Cathedral, so that passengers could read the inscription. It read, "Billy Golding, 1919, prize for general improvement." Well, we all grow up, times change. This, I suppose, might be described as the change from Billy
to Bill are times change, tempora mutanta, noset mutamur in illis. It is significant, as you will see, for the nature of this essay that I should give you that in Latin. I call the essay itself The Ladder and the Tree. Oh, and it is also, I hope some of you may notice, an interesting experience in a quite extraordinary corner of a small and very ancient country town in England, a town so old that one of the grass mounds in the school grounds is said to be the grave of Merlin. It's that kind of place. But then, where is Merlin not buried? The Ladder and the Tree. For most of my life, childhood, boyhood, and more, we lived at Marlborough. Our house was on the green, that close-like square tilted south with a Swindon Road running through it. On both sides of the road is grass, and the houses that stand round are far older than their Georgian exteriors. Our house had no Georgian front, but had been left untouched at the end of the churchyard, under the shadow of St. Mary's Church, three slumped stories of 13th century lath, plaster, and beam, with a crazily gabled porch. There were cellars under the house, and three blanked-off wells. The cellars have walls of dripping flint, ancient disused fireplaces, and cupboards. Though I have seen them recently and marveled to find them small, I cannot tell how old they are. Once there was a south window in the cellar, but now only the rotting sill is left, a beam crushed in the wall. My father amiably rigged me a swing in one dark corner for use on rainy days, but I never used it unless he was there. Never dared to stay alone with the gloom and the crushed wood underground, where a footfall overhead seemed to come down out of another world. So old were the cellars that they must have been dug before the graveyard a few feet away. The graveyard, in those days, I hoped they predated the graveyard, but could not be sure. In daylight, the chances were even, or perhaps more favorable than that. We had a garden at the back of the house, not large, but with lawn, flowers, and a few trees. In daylight, the trees leaned out over the churchyard or over the path through it, and the headstones were nothing but headstones. But as the sun went down behind the church tower, the headstones became stiller than stone, as if they were waiting. When the sun had gone down, I did not look at the churchyard at all, for I knew how the stones were lengthening, lifting and peering blankly, inscrutably over the wall. As I went indoors, if I dared a backward glance or climbed towards the little shot window, I saw how they did indeed peer, but up, always over my shoulder or my head, crowded and still and other. Then I would go quickly to my father or my mother or my brother for human company by the fire. One afternoon, I was sitting on the wall that divided our garden from the churchyard. 8 was I, perhaps, 9, 10, 11, older even. There's nothing by which I can tell. I contemplated the headstones a few feet away and saw suddenly that several of them were flat up against our wall. I remember knowing then that I had seen and thought enough. My nights were miserable as it was, with every sort of apprehension given a label, and these even so only outliers of a central, not comprehended dark. But the sun shone on the wall, and I watched the inside of my head go on and take step after logical step. At which end of a grave does a headstone stand? I remember the sexton, Mr. Baker, calling them headstones. I made the final deduction that the dead lay, their heads under our wall, the rest of them projecting from their own place into our garden, their feet, their knees even, tucked under our lawn. Logic is insistent. I recall an awareness at that moment that I was being foolish, that the demonstration of this proposition would do no one any good and me a great deal of harm. The lawn, almost the only uncontaminated place in that ancient neighborhood, had been sunny and innocent until my deliberate exercise of logic had invited the enemy in. What was that enemy? I cannot tell. He came with darkness, and he reduced me to a shuddering terror that was incurable because it was indescribable. I guess now it causes for all these terrors. Had my mother perhaps feared this shadowy house and its graveyard neighbor when she went there with me as a baby? She was Cornish, and the Cornish do not live next to a graveyard from choice. But we had very little choice. My father was a master at the local grammar school, so that we were all the poorer for our respectability in the dreadful English scheme of things at that time, a scheme which so accepted social snobbery as to elevate it to an instinct. We had a subtle place. Those unbelievable gradations ensured that though my parents could not afford to send my brother and me to a public school, we should nevertheless go to the grammar school, and so on and so on. I did not question such contradictions. But at 8 or 9, the standards of education did not matter. My father could see to that. He was incarnate omniscience. I've never met anyone who could do so much, was interested so much, and who knew so much. He could carve a mantelpiece or a jewel box, explain the calculus and the ablative absolute. He wrote a textbook of geography, of physics, of chemistry, of botany and zoology, devised a course in astronavigation, played the violin, the cello, viola, piano, flute. He painted expertly, knew so much about flowers, he denied me the simple pleasure of looking anything up for myself. He produced a cosmology which I should dearly love to pass off as all my own work, because he never told anyone but me about it. He fell hideously and passionately in love with radio, what we then called wireless, in the very earliest days, and erected an aerial like the one on a battleship. He also had some unused qualifications as an architect. He hated nothing in the whole world unless it were a Tory. And then only as a matter of principle and on academic lines. He stumped the Labour country for the Labour Party, telling the farm labourers the Labour Party did not want to exploit the workers the way the Tories did. It simply wanted to do away with them. He stood proudly and indignantly with my mother on the town hall steps under the suffragette banner and welcomed the overripe tomatoes. He inhabited a world of sanity and logic and fascination. He found life so busy and interesting that he had no time for a career at all. But that was all right. His children would have the career in his place and restore the balance of nature. He and my mother brought us up with a serious care which he gave to nothing else but radio and politics. Sitting on the garden wall then, it was a voice from this world that shouted to me as I pondered on the trap of darkness that was closing. The interruption was too late, for my logical process was complete. So I let myself down and ran indoors as my brother began to shout as well. They were in the hall, grouped round the tangle of wire and tin and glass bulbs that was now my father's obsession. My mother stood with earphones on, and she was looking inside her head. "Listen," said my brother, "let him listen." My mother looked out, lifted off one earphone so that I could listen too. I put my ear to the vulcanite, pressed my ear in against the soft iron diaphragm. My father and brother gazed at me and held their breath. Yes, no illusion this, sure enough, there were sounds in the earphone. There had been sounds before on some occasions, a frying noise usually, and once a chirping which drove my father into mad excitement because he said it was Morse from a ship. But now, in the deep fat, covered over, browned, there was a tiny structure of noise which tickled my ear without particularly interesting it. I listened and waited for something to happen. My father whispered impatiently against my disengaged ear, "It's a violin." Astonished, I saw that my father was different. His usually pink and white face was now white all over. He was sweating. Large drops were trickling down the enormous dome of his head. He was shaking with a depth of emotion that I myself only experienced round about midnight. He bent down and whispered to me out of his world, out of sanity and order, out of boundless hope, out of a torn-up sense of the miracle, "You may never hear a violin as good as that again." My mother lifted her aquiline, capable face away from the headphones. She looked at my father a shade severely, as though the miracle once performed had no business not to continue. "What are you doing, Alec? It's fading away." My father leapt to the hall table where our machinery was. He lifted a row of electrodes out of their solution and held them so, waiting for the battery to recover. We stood dedicated. He lowered them again. My brother shook his head. "It's gone." And so it was. Weeks of gloom were to pass before the radio brought us another offhand miracle. Years before my distraught father won through to serenity and had the machinery tamed, the house wired, and music falling from the air. On that first day, I left him wrestling and muttering over the mess and returned to the contaminated garden. How could I talk to them about darkness and the irrational? They knew so much, had such certainties, were backing all the obvious winners. I floated in their world, holding on to a casual hand, sometimes sinking again in the dark. Then I found Edgar Allan Poe's Tales of Mystery and Imagination. I read them with a sort of shackled fascination and recognized their quality, knew that they were reports, knew that he and I had been in the same place. There was, of course, an escape. From such an impasse, we escape or die or go mad. I had respite from my obsessions. I climbed away from them. Coming along the churchyard from St. Mary's beneath the avenue of pollarded limes, you find the wall on the left heightened suddenly. That was the wall of our garden. We had a chestnut tree which stood in that corner, and I cut it down a few years ago with strangely little regret. Now that the lawn was distasteful, I learned to climb that tree with a kind of absent-minded dexterity. There is something about a tree which appeals not to a vestigial instinct, but to the most human, or if you like, the highest, in a child. The tree to be preferred is rooted in a garden or among houses. In the forest, a tree is no wilder than the ground, is nothing but a single hair on the world's head. But just as a boat attracts in the contrary way by being a house in the savagery of water, so a tree is a bit of the Congo or Antarctica set down next to the paving stones or main drain. Everything else has been shaped, touched, used, and understood, plumbed by powerful adults. But a tree lifts its fork above them, ramifies in secret. There is in a tree only a yard or two over your head that which is most precious to a small boy, an unvisited place, never seen before, never touched by the hand of man. This chestnut tree was my escape. Here, neither the darkness of the churchyard nor this vast pattern of work and career and importance could get at me. The texture of bark, the heraldic shape of sticky buds, these were private, were an innocent reality, were in fact nothing but themselves. Here, stirring the leaves aside, I could look down at the strangers in that world from which we were cut off and reflect on their nature. Safe from the skeletons, from Latin, and the proper requirements of growing up, I could ponder over or snigger at the snatches of conversation from passers-by underneath. There were two little girls who came along, patter-patter through a deserted churchyard in a bright afternoon. One was thin and dark and awe-stricken and excited. The other was fair, a little bigger, giggling and self-appalled. She was leaning down sideways, explaining. As she passed, her voice came into focus. "They get you down and pulls off your clothes." "Giggle away under the trees." What a fierce and dramatic life these girls must lead in their own place, I thought. How cruelly inhuman their treatment of each other. And then the old bookie passed. He was short, grey and square as a sarsen stone. He came from the pub at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He inched along the path with shuffling steps, each no more than a span or less. He inched along, swearing to himself, inscrutably angry, muttering. He would stop, strike at the stone walls with his stick, and inch on. There was that other pair, too, a man and a woman. They stopped below me one evening when the late light of summer and a full moon had encouraged me to brave the shadows and stay in my tree until night. Even the moonlight was hot, molten moonlight, a great dollop of white moon stirred by the twigs and leaves into a shower of moving drops. These two, the man and woman, stood by the wall under me, she against it, he pressing her hard, and they wrestled and murmured gently. She would take her mouth away from his face and say, no, 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 and put it back again. His moony hand was in her neck. Then he began to undo something near her neck, and she said, no, 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 more earnestly, and laughed and giggled. But his hand went right into her chest, and she gave a gasp of pain, like being pricked with a pin or having something raw touched, and the branch I was holding aside flicked back with a swish. They started apart and stood looking up at me or at the covering leaves only a yard away. She said, what was that? He said, it was a bird. His voice had a lot of heartbeat and phlegm in it. But there were footsteps coming past St. Mary's now. The man and woman hurried away. These encounters, real and innocent as the chestnut tree, lives devoid of darkness or career, were still beside the point. I enjoyed their qualities, but had no theories about them. They were pictures put away by me then to be taken out and evaluated later. The tree also let me read what I liked, avidly and uncritically. Crouched in the branches, lifted above fear, I had no doubt that if one frowned long enough at the paper, it would brighten and come alive. Indeed it did. The picture emerged. Details were there to be heard, seen, touched. Percival's sister let down her long hair from the abbey gate, and it swayed gently like Virginia creeper because there was a slight breeze. Pius Aeneas had a stiff neck for 3 days after he carried old Anchises from burning Troy. I know something about Odysseus that is not in the text, since I have seen and touched him. When he was washed up in Phaeacia, his hands were white and corrugated, and his nails bled, not because of the rocks, but because he bit them. I saw him crouched naked beneath the stunted tree, shuddering in the wind, salt drying on his skin, lugging with white teeth at the nail of his third right finger, while he peered at the dark phantom dangers and wondered fearfully what to do. Odysseus the wily, Odysseus the great-hearted, the traveller, the nail-biter. These moving pictures in Technicolor lit the underside of the leaves. This place was where I lived. Among our few acquaintances, I became a sight. People were led to the garden, and I was pointed out to them like a rare bird. My father, kind as ever, even made me a short ladder which would enable me and anyone else who was so inclined to climb the tree easily. That ladder was difficult to break, but the effort was well repaid. The tree, hardly to be distinguished in my mind from the moving pictures, remained inviolate. But down in the house, rooted in the graveyard, things were moving forward. The time had now come when the first steps towards a career must be taken. Yet it was observed I resisted school, or rather let it flow over me. There was Latin, for example. You could not go to Oxford unless you learnt Latin. On the other hand, Latin was useless except to scholars. But my career was to be a scientific one. Science was busy clearing up the universe. There was no place in this exquisitely logical universe for the terrors of darkness. There was darkness, of course. It was just darkness. The absence of light had none of the looming terror which I knew night long and in my very bones. God might have been a help, but we'd thrown him out, along with imperialism, Toryism, the exploitation of women, war, and the Church of England. I nodded agreement, was precocious with the catchphrases of progress. But even in daylight now, the dead under the wall drew up the green coverlet of our grass and lay back with a heart-squeezing grin. Though cosmology was driving away the shadows of our ignorance, though bones were exhibited under glass, though the march of science was irresistible, its path did not lie through my particular darkness. One day I should be part of that organization, marching irresistibly to a place which I was assured was worth finding. The way to it lay through a net of Latin's golden, bumbling words. But Latin marched away from me. I had a divinatory skill in translation, but the grammar seemed related. It doesn't need intelligence, you know, just sticking at it, and you can stick at things. Look at the books you read. You can stick at it. Not Latin grammar. But you've got brains. No. Now look, I'll explain it again. No use. No go. I knew I could not learn Latin grammar for a perfectly clear reason, a logical reason. The logic of childhood is just as good as adult logic, better sometimes because unconditioned. Logic, after all, is only a few different shaped bricks out of which we build skyscrapers. But in childhood, the bricks are of a different shape. I had an adventure book, and the word Latin occurred on page 67. At some time, a blot of ink had fallen on that page and blotted out the word Latin. I knew that in my universe, though not in my father's, this was enough. I should never be able to learn Latin. Haven't you got any brains then? No use. Not for Latin grammar. No go. He never knew. No one else knew. There came a time when I got no marks at all in a Latin test and minus one for bad writing. Then we had a showdown. Let me make one point perfectly clear. My father was generous, loving, saintly in his attitude to his family. He would give up anything for us gladly. He was understanding, too. His human stature grows the more I think of him. Indeed, the further he moves from me in the dark, backward, and abysm of time, it sometimes seems to me I owe more to him and perhaps love him more. If we could not meet at this point, it was no failing of his. It seems more like a defect in the very nature of human communication. What I remember most of that terrible evening is the reasonableness of my father's arguments. If I really did not want to go to Oxford, that was all right. If I would prefer to go into the Merchant Navy, that was all right. If I wanted to leave school at 14, that was all right too. Now, please don't cry. I don't like it when you cry. If you want to forget the whole thing, that's all right. Everything was all right, in fact. And why do I remember such anguish, such tears, such sobs racking up from the soles of my feet, mouth agape, sweat, streaming nose, mouth, eyes, misery, hopeless misery. When I could cry no more, I lay my face a few inches from the white skirting of the hall and jerked and sniffed and shuddered. I was, I saw, in a place. Just as I had recognized that Poe and I knew a place which we shared, so now I knew this place, this atmosphere. It was real, gray, had the quality of promising a dreary familiarity. It was the first step on the road. I saw that I should really do this thing, really learn Latin and grow up. I moved, sniffing, to the dining room, sat down with Richie's first steps in Latin and Richie's second steps in Latin. I needed to begin at the beginning. My father and mother sat on either side of the fire and hardly breathed. I thumbed the books through. Rules, declensions, paradigms, and vocabularies stretched before me. They were like a ladder which I knew now I should climb rung after factual rung, and Sir James Jeans and Professor Einstein were waiting at the top to sign me on. I was glad about science in a remote sort of way. If you're going to be anything, then a scientist was what you ought to be. But the ladder was so long. In this dreary mood of personal knowledge and prophecy, I knew that I should climb it, knew too that the darkness was all around, inexplicable, unexorcised, haunted, a gulf across which the ladder lay without reaching to the light. My parents must have been emotionally exhausted. They stayed quiet, and I worked for 2.5 hours. I found, as in the last hour I had expected, that I could learn the stuff and that it was ridiculously easy. I moved on, surely and quietly, from rung to rung over the dark. My mother came at last and stood by my side. She put her arm round me. "It's not so bad when you get started, is it?" "No, not so bad." All at once the air became light and jolly. We cracked jokes, we laughed, amemus. My father put away his book on vertebrate zoology. "Go on like this," he cried delightedly. "We shall find we have to stop you doing too much Latin." "The next thing," said my mother, "he'll be taking his Latin up the tree."
She'll be back soon.
"The culture of the very numbers could not try the cause."
I hope this mic is live. Can you hear me at the back? If you can't hear me at the back, don't put your hands up. Can you hear me out there? Yes, you can, I see. All right. And this mic is live. That's better. I'm fielding, you said, a couple of questions, did you? Questions. Could you shout that? Did I start my writing up in the tree? No, I was acrobatic, but not quite that much. I generally needed at least one hand and one foot to stay in the tree. And if you work it out, you can't hold a pen and a book at the same time. At least I couldn't with a spare hand and foot. No, I didn't. I did start writing at the age of 7, but that's another story. Well, I don't know Coco the talking gorilla, I'm afraid. If, as I imagine, he's one of the primates that's been taught a sign language, is that it? That's right. Well, I suppose that one must think of human evolution as appearing by a series of, as proceeding by a series of gigantic leaps. In other words, there doesn't seem to be a steady gradualism in human evolution. We do seem to have people who differ vastly from one step to the other. And I should imagine the distance from Coco, well, of course, it isn't even he is a branch on a branch line, isn't he? I mean, we don't come the same way, but even so, the difference in level between Coco and Neanderthal man would be enormous. No, that wasn't said very clearly, but the answer really is no, I don't. I must learn to cut these. Why did the book Lord of the Flies end so abruptly? Well, that is an aesthetic question. How do you get the maximum effect out of a story? Do you see? And the whole book had really been something like this, had it not? Making small boys a paradigm of the human condition, and so suddenly posing them with an adult who is doing exactly what they are doing, that is, hunting down and killing, only he's doing it in a technologically adjusted cruiser instead of just doing it with his hands and his nails. It was that opposition, or if you like, not opposition so much as similarity, which I wanted to point out. That's why the book had to stop boink like that. Also, I wanted Ralph left alive at the end. Okay. I'm told I'm fielding a couple of questions here. Anybody got one? No, not really, because they are too short, too silly, and too unimportant, and I don't want to talk about them. I carried a spear. Well, now hear the question after the answer. Will I tell you about my theatrical experience? Right. And I've given the answer already. No, I won't. What's the other one? Valuable in what extent? In what way? For example, you could say valuable in making money, or you could say valuable in learning about human relationships, or you could say valuable in acquiring some sort of rudimentary ability to deal with the world one finds oneself in. Which of these things? The last one. I think probably the experience of being born as a small boy and brought up, going through that whole mill, having a war to fight, going through that whole mill, marrying a woman and begetting a man-child and a woman-child and seeing them grow up, seeing them get married to other people, naturally enough, and then in their turn have small children, grandchildren, which I watch, this has contributed to any understanding I may have of how to deal with life. In other words, the span of life itself.
No, I think on the contrary that everything means something, but I think I'm being taken away.
No, I'm just asking you to...
As I understand the question, it was the last Nobel, the latest Nobel Prize winner, said that everything means nothing. Is that so, and do I agree with this? Most emphatically not. Okay? My thoughts were entirely neutral. It was quite extraordinary. It's the way one very often comes across, one comes up to experiences that I express, that one expects to be of great significance, and then one finds one's doing them, and one can't really realize one's doing them. You know? Like Oscar Wilde's saying of Niagara when he saw it, the second greatest disappointment a man has on his honeymoon. I don't think they have very much. Oh, how have my views on human nature changed since I wrote Lord of the Flies? I don't think they have very much. I think perhaps they did at the time verge on the simplistic and now have perhaps become a little more subtle. But in general, I would agree with what I thought then. I think it worth remembering that that book was written under the immediate experience of, I suppose, the greatest war in history, or at least one of the two greatest wars in history, and written in the experiencing the shock of finding out what some people could do to others of their own kind. In other words, I'm talking now about concentration camps and that sort of thing. And, of course, one must include things like dropping atom bombs. And I don't wish to take one side in this. I'm merely thinking the human picture, the picture of man as willing to destroy his own kind, willing to torture his own kind, and so on. So that I came through in one essay to the discovery, while I was writing it, or rather while I was delivering the lecture, that Lord of the Flies, the theme of Lord of the Flies, was simply grief. Just human grief at finding out what we were, or if you like, what we are.
Yes. I read that you said the ending of Lord of the Flies is pessimistic, but I see one small thing that gives me some optimism, and I wondered if maybe I'm misinterpreting it. At the end, when the naval officer asks who's in charge, who's the leader, Ralph says he is, and all the boys. Accept that, including Jack. It seems to me, would it be correct to interpret that you feel that eventually, I guess if we don't blow ourselves up to this dictatorship, no matter how strong will fall,
I can't repeat that question because it was more of a speech, wasn't it? But, I'll try and paraphrase it. Precise it, perhaps, and say that you really want to know, is Lord of the Flies wholly pessimistic, or is there any optimism included? That's about it, yes. Well, I think that's... I think the whole existence of Simon is optimistic. I'm assuming now you know the book. I think also the existence of Ralph, to a large extent, is optimistic. He does try, and most of the boys try according to their natures. They're not a pushover. Yes, I think there is optimism, but in the final thing I shall read, this, I hope, will be made clearer.
Is free fall a sort of personal experience or personal exploration?
No, I don't think so. I think it's really based very much on things I saw happening to other people rather than myself. The deprived boy with his deprived childhood and his army experiences and all the rest of it, all this is outside my experience, is invented. Yes?
Question at the back. Did your teaching of adolescence help you in the writing of Lord of the Flies, and if so, how?
Did my teaching of adolescence help me in the reaching of in the writing of Lord of the Flies, and if so, how? Yes, it did, and it was simply the anthropologist in me recording human behavior.
Which book did you enjoy writing the most and why?
Which book did I enjoy writing the most and why? Well, I much enjoyed two late books, one, Rites of Passage, which looks as though it's about the Navy, but is in fact about the English class system. And another one, The Paper Men, which is just a cheerful black comedy based in the combination of the literary and university world. I think I enjoyed those equally. I've written such a great deal. Do I always get questions? Is that what you... On Lord of the Flies? Yes, I do always get questions. What?
How do you feel about that?
Tired. I don't dare.
You talked about it more questions.
What?
You talked about it more questions.
It's okay, right. Shall I do it? Well, now, to conclude, I'd like to read you a part of a late essay of mine. It's singularly in some way like the other essays, except that it deals very much with belief rather than with day-to-day occurrences. But in this essay, I'm only going to read the last part of it. In this essay, I begin more or less with my rolled-up essay becomes an epic sword, and I run round a semicircle of plaster models called Marx, Darwin, and Freud, and smash them to bits. Then we get on to the later bit of the essay, which is not destructive, but I hope constructive, because it more or less, as near as I can, says what I believe, and I would like to leave you with that to remove any misconceptions. I deal with what is important to a novelist, to any artist, if you like, that is the moment of creation, not the day-to-day grind, as it were, but the moments when things are born creatively in my particular craft, as they are born, say, to the musician or to the poet or the artist. Imagine this writer, this novelist, this storyteller, spinning a longer and longer string of single words. Imagine him at one of the lambent moments that are his equivalent of the poet's lyric impulse. There is exultation, but there is also fear, sometimes a kind of terror, since the method of expression is not a few sentences, but pages of them, not stanzas, but incidents, an incident, a whole happening in the world that has flared up inside him, so that he knows that this is it, this is what the book is about, this is what he is for, or to be colloquial as the occasion demands, he knows he is on to something good. So there is terror as his pen races to overtake the event before it dims or smashes, before the details blur or vanish, or stand there round him to be set down while the man from Porlock hammers on the door. Consciousness is an area. There is room in the writer's awareness for more than the simulacrum of abundance, however that abundance may seem to blaze. Somewhere, shall we say metaphorically, somewhere in the shadows at the edge of the area stands a creature, an assessor, a judge, a broken-off fragment of the total personality which surveys the interior scene with a desperate calm and is aware how he wishes it to proceed. He is all the time controlling things, admonishing them. He is a divided creature. Then it may be if he has what? Luck? Grace? Lightning? The new thing appears from nowhere. We will stick to a spatial metaphor that I've used because here it is at the very center. The new thing appears from a point in the area of his awareness, from a position without magnitude, which of course is quite impossible. Yet this is the occasional operation of creativity. I have said that the psychologist's proposition that imagination is only the rearrangement of material in the mind is not true. Here I will present that as a denial and not argue it. The moments of genuine creativity must argue for me, if not with everybody, at least with those who've experienced the moments or appreciated them, but my hope is better. The writer watches the greatest mystery of all. It is the moment of most vital awareness, the moment of most passionate and unsupported conviction. It shines or cries. There is the writer trying to grab it as it passes, as it emerges impossibly and heads to be gone. It is that twist of behavior, that phrase, sentence, paragraph, that happening on which the writer would bet his whole fortune, stake his whole life as a true thing. Like God, he looks on his creation and knows what he has done. A truth, an unsupported conviction, like God. You observe that if I am trying to give the storyteller his due, I am also trying to give him no more than that. Poets, in the search for that real thing, may assert the same knowledge, but more proudly and with bardic aplomb. Mock on, Voltaire, Rousseau. Mock on, 'tis all in vain. You throw the dust against the wind, and the wind blows it back again. Or perhaps, proudest and most enigmatic of all, j'ai sur la clé de cette parade sauvage. We, the storytellers, must produce a more bumbling truth, and it has to be sought for in that extended cooperation that must go on between the novelist and his reader. Yet our feeling that we have a truth, if it does not shake the world, is worth having on our pedestrian level. Indeed, coming up from the deep sea or back from one of those rare moments of insight, the writer will see human awareness not with a God's eye view, but then with a worm's eye view. Your emerging literary worm is your true heretic. He has a kind of confusion that often cripples him for the integrated and calm traffic of daily life. Yet, ironical as it may sound, the emerging worm will feel himself to be the true human being. Those of you who may still remember Peter Brook's production of the Mahasad may remember how at the end the mad men and women on the stage rushed downstage and applauded us. For we, the audience, were the true actors, there where we sat in our respectable rows with all our natural instincts and impulses subdued and civil. So a novelist, having gone down from the confusion of daily experience to the supportive multiplicity beneath it, and come up once again to the magical area of his own intuitions, will come to the scaffolding and supportive machinery of his story, and then, finding himself faced with an accepted world, will slash it to bits. Those of you who are acquainted with anything I have written are likely to have read Lord of the Flies. I am not going to explicate the book for you. That has been done so often by others, has been subjected to Marxist, Freudian, Neo-Freudian, Jungian, Catholic, Protestant, humanist, nonconformist analysis and opinion, has been buried with its author under a pile of not always sweet-scented international criticism so deeply there is nothing left to say. The book yields readily to explication, to instruction, to the trephining of the pupil's skull by the teacher, and the insertion into the pupil's brain by the teacher of what the pupil ought to think about it. I would like the pupil or anyone else to enjoy the book if he can. For my own part, I have moved on to other books. I've always felt that a writer's book should be as different from each other as possible. Though I envy those writers who can go on writing the same book over and over again, it is not something I can do myself. I do not see myself writing a book about a group of girls on an island. Yes, I have moved on. Though in general terms I would still assent to the philosophical or theological implications about the nature of man and his universe presented in the book, today, more than a generation later, I would qualify them as subtler and less definable than I once thought. God works in a mysterious way, says the hymn, and so it seems does the devil. Or, since that word is unfashionable, I'd better be democratic and call him the leader of the opposition. Sometimes the two seem to work hand in hand. Sometimes neither is on call, even if you call them louder. They are asleep or away hunting, perhaps. Perhaps hunting each other. Sometimes I feel myself, then, to have committed acts of fearful asseveration. How did I ever dare? Shall I ever dare again? What man is? Whatever man is under the eye of heaven, that I burn to know, and that, I do not say this lightly, I would endure knowing. The themes closest to my purpose, to my imagination, have stemmed from that preoccupation, have been of such a sort they might move me a little nearer that knowledge. There have been themes of man at an extremity, man tested like building material, taken into the laboratory and used to destruction. Man isolated, man obsessed, man drowning in a literal sea or in the sea of his own ignorance. I've tried to say how the process of writing such a book appears to the man who does it. You may say I take him, take myself, take my craft too seriously. Yet if there is anything of value in those books, their richest moments appear to me in their genesis as mysterious as anyone else. I will take myself and my craft now with a seriousness that may seem outrageous to you and laughable. In my awareness, in the three-dimensional absurdity of a surface moving through time, discoveries, creations, appear impossibly from a point, a position without magnitude. This, then, is the terrifying thought to the frail human creature that all creation may be of the same or a related nature. The novelist is God of his own interior world. Commonly, men make God in their own image. He is a warrior, a lover, a mathematician, a father, son, mother, a remote universal and a small image in the corner of a room. Let us add our quota of inadequate description and say that he is of all things an artist who labors under no compulsion but that of his own infinite creativity. Are we, in some sense, his novels? We are said to be made in his image, and if we could but understand our flashes of individual creativity, we might glimpse the creativity of the ultimate creator. See how prose limps after the blinding fact. Verse does it better as usual. Tennyson does it better. Flower in the crannied wall, I pluck you out of the crannies. I hold you here, root and all, in my hand, little flower. If I could understand what you are, root and all in all, I should know what God and man is. Tennyson comes back at last, not to the complexity of explanation, but to the simplicity of his own awareness. Now, if there has been any coherent argument in what I have said, it leads to a proposition that could see the end of all literary criticism and analysis, whatever you may think of that possibility. The proposition is that writing, when you get down to it, like running, like eating, like pursuit, is a simple, direct thing, uncomplicated, natural, like the act of being, a wholeness, which is in itself a defier of analysis. It must be the mills, after all. Goodbye, Piccadilly. Farewell, Leicester Square. Où sont les neiges d'antan? Leave us and trilling, lay thee all adown. My lady cometh, that all this may disdain. Ballet de ballet carolos en. Drop it, Towser. Drop it, I say. If you are a teacher or critic, this may seem to you the ultimate heresy, the ultimate pessimism. Indeed, you might have expected some such conclusion, for I have been called a pessimist in my time. So you might call the physician who sets out to diagnose a disease, though he cannot cure it, a pessimist. I should disagree with you, but after such a long, hard haul, you have the right to hear what my sense of wonder and thinking has led me not to know but to guess about the nature of things. Though universe and cosmos are the same word in the dictionaries, one Latin, the other Greek, I will distinguish between them, like Humpty Dumpty making words mean what I tell them to. I will use cosmos to mean what Tennyson meant with all in all and all in all, the totality, God and man, and everything else that is in every state and level of being. Universe I will use for the universe we know through our eyes at the telescope and microscope and open for daily use. Universe I use for what Bridges called God's orrery. With that distinction in mind, I would call myself a universal pessimist, but a cosmic optimist. The extent of my guesses is outrageous. In their irradiation, I manipulate the arrangement of such lucky flashes of creativity as come my way. I guess we are in hell. We can say, if we will, with Marlowe's Mephistopheles, why, this is hell, nor am I out of it. But suffering as he was, Mephistopheles was still cunning enough not to give away the whole game. It would deny the nature of our own creativity, let alone the infinitude of God's creativity, if there were no more than one universe, one hell. There must be an infinite number of them, parallel perhaps, interpenetrating, some ugly, some beautiful, some sad, some joyous, most surely, though this may be the defect of my own imagination, somewhat like our own, a mixture of the lot, and all restless, all sustained by the creatures that inhabit them. To be in a world which is a hell, to be of that world, Neither to believe in nor guess at anything but that world is not merely hell, but the only possible damnation, the act of a man damning himself. It may be, I hope it is, redemption to guess that perhaps, and perhaps perceive that the universe, the hell which we see, for all its beauty, vastness, majesty, is only part of a whole which is quite unimaginable. I have said that the act of human creativity, a newness starting into life at the heart of confusion and turmoil, seems a simple thing. I guess it is a signature scribbled in the human soul, sign that beyond the transient horrors and beauties of our hell, there is a good which is ultimate and absolute.
Do you want me to sit down or shall I go away? Sit here.
Dr. Jerry Zaflov, head of the Department of English at Simon Fraser University, will thank Mr. Golding.
It seems William Golding has traveled a long way from the private chestnut tree in his childhood. But in doing so, he has thrown light and shadow to Vancouver, but perhaps the light and shadow began before 1616 with the conflict between Prince Hal and Falstaff. I'm sure this world is closer to us now than any of us could have imagined without his public and convivial reading. Next, he has one more stop on his cross-Canada tour, an obscure island about an hour and 20 minutes southwest of Tsawwassen, where some old rulers have developed some strange and wondrous habits. I hope, on behalf of the Vancouver Institute and the organizations which have brought Mr. Golding to Vancouver, I hope you will join me one more time in thanking him for bringing his novelist world to Vancouver.
Next week, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. John Halliwell of this university talking on Canada's economic performance, 1955 to 1990.
Thank you. very sorry about last night. You know, we couldn't go. We were having a very early night. Well, we would have loved it, but, we thought we'd got this cold coming on. And I think now I've got it.
Who's going to tell us?
What's that? Oh, God, I hope we haven't got it. But, are you coming?
I'm coming. I just got this very small VW. I think I don't want to keep it.
We were talking to somebody named Albert. You know?